You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Anne-Marie Wells. What I think is interesting about this particular story is that after we completed the interview and it was sort of sinking into my noggin, I was thinking back on it. And the decision or the choice that Anne-Marie made can be looked at in a way, it can be seen as changing pretty much every part, every facet of her life moving forward. It impacted her career, where she lived, who her partner was as a romantic relationship. So many things can shift on what at first seems like a small decision. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's do this. Anne-Marie Wells, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to be here.
I'm really happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. Okay, so I begin every single one of my conversations by asking people to share where they are in the world. So where are you when I'm talking to you today?
I'm in Northern Virginia in the outskirts of DC.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. It's cold there. You guys are having, we're recording this in February. I think you guys are having some winter storms.
That's correct. We just had 7 inches of snow, I think, last
night.
Oh my
gosh.
It's a winter wonderland here.
That sounds delightful. It sounds fantastic. All right. I love to learn a little bit about people's personal background before we get into the topic of the day. So maybe tell us a little bit about you that was not related to what we're going to talk about today. Who are the important people in your life? Do you have pets? What are your hobbies? That kind of thing.
Sure. I have a partner and we have a beautiful 10-month-old son named Orion. And those are the two main co-conspirators in my life. And yes, I have a lot of close friends. Hobbies. Ooh.
Your hobby
hobbies
is
outside of what
raising
I
a
do for my
ten-month-old
life.
baby.
Yeah. What are my hobbies outside of what I do for life? I do enjoy yoga. I love I was gonna say reading, but I also do that for like my work. So but I love to read not for work too. And I'm one of those people. I wouldn't say I'm a workaholic, but I love what I do, so I do what I love type of thing.
I think that's perfectly fine. I think that's very fair. 10 months old, are you getting a full night of sleep?
No, I haven't gotten a full night of sleep since before I was pregnant. I had terrible insomnia while I was pregnant, and my son still doesn't sleep completely through the night. If we have a really good night of sleep, he wakes up at 4 without waking up before then, and that's like we're hallelujah.
Right. You feel
We're
like you can
just
take over the
so
world.
grateful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I
Exactly.
do.
Yeah, we haven't.
Yeah, I remember
Haven't
those.
quite made it there yet.
I remember those. We call it nighttime parenting just to make it sound like it's better than it is, which is really just staying up and getting up whenever they get up. All right. So now we're going to go dive into the topic of the day. You proposed the topic of caregiving for your dad and how that led to you changing careers. So does that sound like what we want to talk about today?
Absolutely. Yes.
Let's
Hopefully
do
it'll
it.
be inspiring to some listeners.
That's the goal. That's the goal. Motivational and inspirational, 100%. So let's start at the end, though. Like a lot of times I do these stories of transformation and I back way up it right at the beginning. But let's start at the end with what you actually do now. Today, as a profession, what do you do?
Well, I copy edit and proofread manuscripts. That's my bread and butter. But I also am a creative writing instructor and facilitate workshops virtually and all over. I travel to facilitate creative writing workshops, particularly my Synonyms for Grief creative writing workshop, where I help non-writers and writers alike to use creative writing to help navigate their grief journeys. And
Oh, wow.
that's my big why right now.
That is very all right. So I love that. I think that that's a really interesting thing. I actually know somebody who is doing a grief. She's doing travel as a grief tool, a tool for grief. She's that's what was helpful for her in a grief journey she did. So I think it's very interesting to find that all the different ways that people move through it. Writing and grief, I think, is a well-tested thing. Maybe not creative writing though, as much as like the sort of journaling thing. But anyway, I'm off topic. So what did you study in school? What was that you thought you wanted to do, backing up to when you were younger, maybe high school, what you studied in
Oh,
school?
yeah. Yeah, so I went to school for environmental science. I graduated undergrad in environmental studies and then earned my master's degree in ecology and tried my darndest to break into the ecology field professionally and struggled, struggled, struggled to find a full-time benefited position in my field. Yeah, so that was also part of my transition into the creative arts and really doing what I loved and what I was currently doing and loving instead of struggling to find a role that wasn't coming to me. It was like the universe was saying, "Oh no. That's not for you." And I actually I don't know if you have like a follow-up question, but the fact that I couldn't find a position in my field was paramount to this journey. I struggled. I was applying to jobs all over the place. I was living in Jackson, Wyoming, which is right outside the Teton National Park and the Yellowstone National Park. So you would think there'd be a lot of ecology positions, and it wasn't panning out for me.
So
And
I
right
do have a question.
before, yeah, go. Sure, go ahead.
What kind of jobs are ecology jobs? So, because I'm not sure what that means. Like, what were the jobs that you were hoping to get that you couldn't find?
Sure. Well, I was really hoping to get into some field research. That's where you go out into a habitat, you collect data. If
Okay.
you're studying a specific species, you're observing and studying it over time. There's also positions as park rangers or environmental educators. You're doing, field trip groups and things like that at the wildlife m museum, things like that. They're a wide scope. There's also landscape mapping and things like that.
Okay.
You create maps of habitats. You can create models of how climate change, for example, can impact certain species, or if an invasive species comes into an area, how that might impact other species in a domino effect. Yeah, there's,
Okay.
you know,
That gives
all
me.
scope of different positions that could
All
be
right. That
possible.
gives me a whole different feel of what you were looking for in terms of what the ecology was in the environmental science. And so you were actively looking for a job. You were living in Wyoming, such a beautiful place. Oh my gosh. So
Yeah.
are you from the Northeast where you live now, or how did you end up in Wyoming? Did you go because it's such a beautiful place, or like how did you get there?
I was well, I'm from upstate New York. I was
Okay.
originally born in Utica outside of Syracuse, New York. And after grad school, when I was applying for jobs, I ended up getting a temporary job at a nature-based play school. Our preschool, nature-based and play-based preschool in Wyoming. And
Okay.
so that's what brought me out there originally. And then I just kind of got sucked in and hung out there for, well, in and out. I tried different other locations for about 10 years and then ended up coming back to the East Coast. My sister lives here, and my partner's family is, or he's from here, and so his family is still here as well. So
So
it
you
just kind of
gave
made
it
sense.
a long try, though. You were looking for a job and living out there for 10 years pursuing ecology.
Eight at the time. Yeah, eight at the
Eight.
time.
All right. That all right. So now we've got a feel for what you're doing now. That's the change, what you studied in school. There it sounds like if you were doing research and writing, there's an element of writing, but a different kind of writing, reports and grants and all of those things. So that was a part of what you studied. So it's not necessarily that you were like not writing, but this is a pretty significant shift. So I think this is going to be the more emotional part of the story. We're going to jump right in with both feet. Tell us what was going on and how you ended up being called in as a caregiver for your dad.
Yeah, interestingly, paradoxically, I should say, or ironically, right before I received the call, I had just landed a job as an executive director for a science education organization, a
Oh,
nonprofit.
wow. Wow. Manifestation folks would say that was a test.
Exactly. I got exactly what I wanted. I had been trying for so long and finally nailed what I thought was my dream job. And then 2 months later, I got the call from my mom. My dad had been in the hospital, not being able to breathe and feeling very out of breath. And he was in the hospital for about a month as they were doing tests and treating him. And I got the call that he had stage four lung cancer. And I remember this feeling of pins and needles just fell over me like a shower. And I asked my mom, like, well, what do I do? Do I come to be with you right now, or if it's going to be 5 years? And she just interrupted me and she said, it's not going to be 5 years, honey. So I knew in that moment that my life was changed forever, that I was never going to be the same after that. And I started making plans to work remotely. Luckily, and this was pre-pandemic, so this was 2019. Before Zoom was really a thing, but I was planning on working remotely. And I did at first. I uprooted my whole life. I got a subletter for my apartment and I packed up my dog and everything that I would potentially need. And I drove from Wyoming to Florida, where my parents were living, to go be with them and to support them, whatever was necessary. As one of my filler jobs before I landed this job as the executive director, I worked as a caregiver for adults with disabilities. So I had training and skills to help individuals who struggled with mobility or who couldn't feed themselves, who used adult diapers, who needed help going to the bathroom. And I used that training caregiving for my dad. In the beginning, it was both a slow and quick decline, where when I first got there, he seemed great. He was happy. He could walk. He could stand up on his own. He was still eating, and slowly but quickly, he didn't have an appetite, was sick all the time, was very weak, couldn't stand on his own. He went from a walker to a wheelchair. And there was a moment when he couldn't get up, and he was very, very ill after his last chemo round, and my mother and I decided to call the ambulance to have him taken to the hospital. And when I was there and he was in the gurney, so weak he couldn't hold an ice chip in his mouth because he was so weak, couldn't speak. I thought my father was going to die that night. I didn't think that he was going to make it. It was actually the anniversary of his mother's death. She
Oh.
had died, I think, maybe 15 years before that moment. And I stayed with him in the hospital. My mom went back to her house to sleep. I slept, didn't sleep on the little couch next to his bed.
Those are not actually meant for sleeping. I don't know why they even put them in the rooms. It's the craziest thing. They're so
Yeah.
uncomfortable. No one fits on them.
I couldn't sleep. I was worried that if I fell
Yeah.
asleep, he would need me and I wouldn't be awake, or he would have his last moments and I wouldn't be there. And I was compelled to write a poem. I wasn't a poet before then. I did write. I loved to write, but mostly blogs. And then I wrote some romantic comedy plays. So
Wow.
definitely a different genre. And I didn't have paper. I grabbed a receipt out of my bag that I had with me. Didn't have a pen. I was so compelled, I went and borrowed a pen from the nurse's station. And I wrote a poem about being at the beach with him when we saw a nest of baby turtles emerging out of the sand
Oh,
and
wow.
making their way to the ocean. And this was before smartphones, so I don't have good. I took a picture on my like flip Motorola phone at the time. And just watching, we watched until the sun went down, watching baby after baby coming out of the sand and just flopping to the
Yep.
ocean, just knowing instinctively to go there, and then watching them wash away with the tide. It was such a beautiful moment. And as he was next to me, gray, maybe needing a blood transfusion, hooked up with all of the tubes and everything, I wrote a poem about how that was what I was going to remember, that
Yeah.
I would remember that. And because I had some experience in writing, I had been to some writers' conferences, and I worked part-time for literary nonprofit. I kind of knew the I wouldn't say rules, but the protocols for getting your poems and short stories published. I knew, oh, there are literary journals
So
that I could
before we
send
jump
this
into
out
that,
to. Yeah, go ahead.
let's talk a little bit more about your dad. And sorry to
Yeah.
cut you off. I
That's okay.
did not want to jump in while you were talking about the story and interrupt the flow because it was such a beautiful story, but I do have some questions, if that's okay. So one of the questions I had when you were telling the story is that I was curious whether or not when your mom called you with the diagnosis, had your dad been sick before, or was that the first? Did you guys find out with stage four?
We found out with stage four. He was
Yeah.
always very vibrant. I mean, he walked the dog multiple times a day, was going to the beach and walking there. And yeah, he was a heavier person, but he wasn't in and out of the hospital. He didn't have an inhaler. He
None
wasn't
of
on like
those
a slew of
things.
medications or anything like that.
That's such a tough thing, right? Like, 'cause I think that my concept of like end of life stuff when I was younger, I mean younger, like in my teens and 20s, was really that, there would be more notice. It would be like
Right.
an announcement. It's like, oh, you're a little bit sick, and then you would go through that. And now there's a thing that I read about several years ago, which is, compression. It's like you lead a healthy life, and then the time where you're sick and declining can be very short. And that actually, if I was to write my future, that's what I'm championing, because I think that an extended period of sick for myself is not my goal. You don't actually get to write this part of our story, but that's my, if I get to put the vote
Yeah.
in, that's what I'm voting for me. And then the thing I was thinking of, I had two other questions, was share with us about how old you were when this was happening. How old were you, and how old was your dad?
I was 33 and
Okay,
my dad
pretty
was
young.
74.
Yeah, so pretty young when we talk about how old adults are when they lose their parents. I was about 36 when my dad died. It was one of the youngest people I knew, one of the first people in my friend group to lose a parent. There's, I mean, not any rules. People lose parents even as children. Somebody, when I was going through it, described it for me as joining a club that most people do join, but nobody wants to.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was pretty spot on. Then I have a very self-centered question to ask you, which is just total. So I'm in Florida. What part of Florida were your parents in?
Vero Beach on the East
Oh yeah.
Coast.
So I'm in Miami. So, so there's that. So I was just curious. The turtle memory, that is a quintessential like coastal tropical experience. I've done a turtle release. I've never actually seen a wild turtle hatching. That is a spectacular memory.
I've never seen it before or since.
That is a really, really, and I love the part of this story that when you were bonding with your dad in the hospital, that a strong positive memory like came to your mind. I think that's really special. I want to thank you for sharing that with us. I think that stories of caregiving for children and parents, it's a thing that I think we do a terrible job getting people ready to do. And I think that it's helpful to tell the story so that people can begin to just have an inkling in their mind that someday this might pop up. So, how long was, I'm going to ask you now, how did your life shift while you were caregiving? I'm not sure exactly how long this period of time was in your
It
life,
was
but
short.
you, yeah.
Yeah. When I had asked my mom on the phone, my dad had his vocal cords were paralyzed, and
Okay.
so he could whisper, but it was hard to talk on the phone. And he was whispering all the time because he couldn't project without his vocal cords. So talking to my mom on the phone, she said that he had a year. But what I didn't know was that she was told he had 6 months or less up to a year with treatment. And
Oh
since he
my
was
goodness.
pursuing treatment, she told me a year. So in my head, I thought we had a year. But we ended up having 4 months from
From the phone call.
diagnosis to burial. Yeah.
That is short and intense, my goodness. So during that time, you picked up your entire life in Wyoming and relocated to be with your family, and you were working remotely. That's a major change. And that, when we talk about changes and decisions and things, the decision, you had an option that you didn't choose, which was to allow your mom to be the primary caregiver and keep your life in Wyoming. But when you took that on, moving and relocating is a huge emotional challenge. One of the top, when they make those ridiculous lists that are like hardest things people do, right? Moving is always there. And so is losing somebody, like the death of a family member. Those are two, and you did them at the same time. You must have been under an enormous amount of pressure.
Yeah, I was. At the time, because we knew my dad had a limited amount of time, my partner at the time and I decided to get married. So I
Oh,
was
because
also organizing a wedding.
as one does. So what we need now in the middle of all of this is to plan a wedding. Actually, I do understand why you would do that, but yes. All right. So that was a lot.
It was a lot. My partner was also back and forth between Florida and Wyoming. He wasn't able to work remotely, so he was taking time off or spending the weekend and just spending a lot of money on flights back and forth
It is
between Florida and
not
Wyoming.
easy to get from Palm Beach International Airport to Wyoming. That is not a direct flight, as far as I know.
No, it never is. Either landing in Denver or Chicago or Charlotte. So,
Yeah.
one or Austin or Houston. There's always a connecting flight. Yeah.
One of the times I flew in, I don't remember if it was Wyoming or Wyoming. I did Atlanta and then over to Salt Lake City and then up. I mean, it just took forever to get there, just really a long time. So that's a lot of stuff going on. So 4 months. Wow. So you write the poem in the hospital with your dad on the back of the receipt. How cl did that end up being his last day, or was there other time? You don't have to get into specific details, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. He lived for a little less than 2 months after
After
that.
that.
Yeah.
So, was it an immediate thing for you that you were like, you know what, I am going to publish this poem? You talked about that you had a little bit of knowledge of the publishing industry, which it does. Like, with some perspective here, it is a little bit like the things that you had chosen earlier in your life were coming together to bring you a skill set. Like, you had done caregiving, which set you up to be an asset in this decision. You had done some publishing work, which then when you decided to do it, you had a little bit of information. That's an interesting synchronicity. So, how was it immediate that you made this decision? I'm going to publish this poem.
No, at first it was just, I need to write another poem. I
Okay.
have this other poem that I need to write, and then this other poem that I need to write. And then suddenly I had a dozen, two dozen poems, and I didn't know if they were any good. I didn't know. I at that point I hadn't read poetry collections really, one or two here or there, but I wasn't into poetry. It wasn't like my thing. And so I had maybe a handful of them, and I said, you know what, I'll send them out to some literary magazines and see what happened. You know, no fee, not the ones that you have to pay a fee, because you know I was just budding, but just to see what happened. And then within a few weeks I got an email saying, we would love to publish your poem. And I'm like, what?
That's
I was so
amazing.
surprised.
That's amazing. You are the
Yeah.
second published author that I've interviewed for the show. The other was a book, and she her book is coming out in a couple of days, and her episode is coming out in February. She pitched a publisher because she was having trouble finding agents, and it just immediately got picked up for this book deal. And I love sharing these stories because the number of people that I have talked to over the past 10 or 15 years who want to publish a book and are just really, really challenged to find somebody to publish them. And they get a concept in their head. They're like, this just doesn't work the way it used to. And nobody ever gets published. And to hear stories of people who are saying, I just pitched it. And as it so happens, somebody said yes. Good job.
Yeah, so the first poem that I wrote was the first poem I ever had published as well. And before my dad passed away, I was able to tell him that five of my poems were accepted for
Oh my
publication.
goodness. That's
Yeah.
beautiful. That's beautiful.
And that was the beginning of something much bigger that I didn't even realize. So I was working remotely after my dad ended up in the hospital. He ended up having sepsis and pneumonia on top of his stage four lung cancer.
Oh, poor guy.
And I was already working half time. And then I asked to work quarter time. And then a little more than a month after that, my dad was referred to hospice, and I just resigned. I could not care about budgets and scheduling and interacting with people. And all I wanted to do was write about this experience. I was blogging at the time, mostly because I didn't have the capacity to explain to every single one of my friends and well-meaning acquaintances what I was experiencing,
Yeah.
what my dad was experiencing. I was receiving invasive questions like, is he in pain? Yes. And
Yeah.
what answer do you want me to be giving you? Or how long does he have? And it's just none of their business. And don't remind me that it's not
Yeah.
very long. And so I was blogging about the experience, and it was such a catharsis to get everything out and just allow whoever wants to read it can read it. Friend, enemy, whoever's interested, they can read my vulnerability and my intimate thoughts, and then I don't have to explain it to everybody, or people aren't relaying my story from one person to the next. They can hear it straight from me all at once. And those blog posts were the foundation that became my memoir in verse that was published in 2023, so 3 years after my dad passed away.
Wow.
My
So when
book
you say you
survived
were
by it.
blogging, were you doing like Caring, like a one of the Caring Bridge sites, or were you like you had like a blogger site, like you were just free verse, like doing it on your own?
Yeah, I was just doing it on my own.
That's very nice. It is one of the challenges. People write about it all the time that nobody really knows how to handle those conversations surrounding very, very sick people. Nobody's the wrong word, but it is a situation where people do mess it up a lot. And if you haven't been through it, you don't know. I now have, I'm older than you are, I think. And as you age and more people go through it, within groups of people, there become these little sort of keepers of the information. And then when you find out that something's happening, you learn to call that person who like will tell you, okay, so with this person, they don't want you to call, you know, they go over here to get the information and they're the ones that set up like whatever the people need. But it is stunning how invasive a very simple question can feel when you're going through a hard time. And I don't know about you, but how like crazily I sometimes reacted. After my dad died, I was talking to some poor service person at a bank, and just they said the wrong thing, and I just lost it. And even as I was having like my breakdown, I was like, I know this isn't you, and I really want to apologize, but I'm having a little bit of trouble stopping my tantrum.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with my car mechanic. We actually had I don't know, a more emotional relationship than you have with your average car mechanic. I saw him as like a father figure. We didn't spend time together outside of the car shop or anything, but I needed to get my car repaired so I could travel across the country in it. And I told him I was kind of on a time crunch and why. And he told me that his wife had died from brain cancer. And just said, people say, I know how you feel. No, you don't.
No.
No, you don't know how I feel. And even if you had a wife who died of brain cancer, you still don't know how I feel. It's still not the same. Everybody's individual. And I remember that he asked me, how long does he have? I said a year, and he said, if you're lucky, it'll be less. And I was so angry. I was just like, what an asshole. Like, why
Right.
would you say that to me? If you're lucky, it will be less. And then I experienced it, and
Yeah.
I saw the suffering, how the chemo rendered dad's hands useless. He wasn't able to hold anything in his hand. He couldn't feel. He had no sense in his hands. So he couldn't hold a spoon to feed himself. He couldn't hold his pills to give them to himself. So he needed everything done for him. I sponge bathed him. I rubbed lotion into his feet and his legs, and he was always in a good spirits. He was even making jokes and everything, but that wasn't the life that he wanted to live.
Right.
He didn't want to live that life. He didn't want to keep living just to be bedridden in hospice.
Yeah, and you don't
And
have, you know, you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice, which is a crazy thing to think of. One of the things that I talked to, I knew somebody who was going through it. And one of the things that really pushed her buttons at the end with her family is people would ask if they could come visit. And she was like, no. Like, stop bugging me. Like, if we wanted you here, we would have called you. You know? People probably feel differently about that in different families, but like it's a very, very delicate situation. It brings out the best and worst in people. People who work at hospice are, in my experience, generally awesome, and you can follow their lead. So I agree with that. So you didn't just stop with the poem. And you published the poem. I'm thrilled to hear that you got news about that while your dad could still be sharing with you. You wrote a memoir in verse. That's amazing. I think your notes said that you've published two poetry books.
Correct. Yes. A second one is titled Mother, comma, Verb, a different kind of grief journey of wanting to become a parent and it not happening in the timeline that I was hoping that it would, and the struggle to enter into the life that I'm living now.
So this is really an interesting transformation because you say you were not a student or a fan of poetry when this started, but you have really developed as a poet. Part of this is that you went back to school, I think, to study
I
writing.
did. Yes. So after my dad passed away, 2 weeks before I was supposed to get married, we canceled the wedding, which ended up being good because my former partner and I are no longer together. But he's a wonderful person. We still keep in contact and know we have, as far as I know, we have no ill feelings toward each other.
Let's go with that.
And he's still in Jackson, and every time that I've visited, we've always gotten coffee and caught up and everything. So it's all good. Also glad that we didn't get married at the time. But so we didn't get married, and then the pandemic happened.
Okay.
So also grateful in hindsight that my father passed away and we were able to have a funeral for him before everything went into lockdown. I can't imagine what my life and trauma would have been like had he died and I wasn't able to be there. I was there in the room. I held his hand as he died. And if that wasn't possible, I know that for many people that was the case, whether they passed away from COVID or otherwise.
Or other
And
things, yeah.
I can't imagine having to go through that added level of trauma to the experience.
I can't either. And the stories were crazy. The separation because the facilities to keep in at-risk seniors had restrictions, but those restrictions meant isolating them from their family, which would, I mean, just had to be crazy unpleasant for everybody involved. I know somebody who they had just moved their father into a new facility when it went into lockdown. And then they had to like immediately within a month, they were like, this is, we can't do this. So he didn't have any chance to like learn the routines or anything. And they were trying to, I was just a bystander hearing the vent fests, like the frustration stories, but crazy,
Absolutely.
crazy stuff. So then did you do school online? Is that what you did? You signed up for like
Yeah.
an MFA or something?
So I went back to Wyoming, and started my caregiving job again.
Okay.
And that job is 3 12-hour shifts during the week and allowed me to then take classes remotely. And everything was online suddenly, not just university and college classes, but these different literary organizations that were in Boston and Los Angeles and Seattle suddenly were opening up to virtual classes where before they were all in person. So not only was I able to take these classes to then earn my degree in English, but I was able to really inundate myself with workshops and free workshops. I didn't have to pay for a lot of them. A friend of mine who was more of an acquaintance but now is a closer friend, shortly after my dad passed away, her father was diagnosed with cancer. And she turned to me, and this happened multiple times, actually. Multiple friends received diagnoses after the fact, particularly with their fathers. And she said, "How do I do this? What did
Yeah.
you do? What, how do I experience this?" And I told her, honestly, I started writing poetry, and that has been what has gotten me through this. And so she started writing poetry too. And
All
then
right.
in writing poetry, she learned about what would normally be an in-person poetry course, 2 semester poetry course through the Community Literature Initiative had turned to virtual because of the pandemic. And so before they were only really taking anybody who lived in Los Angeles who could come to these classes, now anybody could. sign up and take the classes virtually. And so she and I were in the same class and taking this poetry course together 3 hours a week, plus office hours, and working on specifically putting together a poetry collection. And
Fantastic.
yeah, so that also I think was a formative experience of now suddenly I'm in this brand new culture that I hadn't experienced before of all these poets. Like before it's like, well, who else is a poet? I don't know any poets. And
Right.
now,
I
oh,
didn't.
there are millions of them.
That is very cool. And it's another synchronicity that lined up that you went through this, and then it's one of the things that one of the powerful parts about sharing our stories is that it gives other people permission to ask. One of the challenges in that is that sometimes we're sharing stories. We don't have control over the part of our story we share, and it still gives you other people permission to talk to you about it, even if you don't want to. So it doesn't always work out as well, but it is really nice that you were able to help people walk through that. And you decided that's a part of what you do now. So tell people what you do now again and how they can find you, because it does feel to me like you've brought a lot of this stuff all together in a beautiful way.
Yeah, so I mean, the book publication wasn't overnight. So that was a 2 year process of sending it out to indie presses and contests and revising it when it was rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected and rejected until finally I got that one yes, we want to publish your book. And then even after that, there was still revision. And in creating this book, it's my how-to guide of handling the news that your loved one has less than a year to live.
Yeah.
Before that, I didn't have any kind of guide. And the people who read it, the people who still read it, send me emails, contact me through my website or on social media. Thank you so much. You put into words how I felt but didn't know how to say it. I received that
That's
message countless
amazing.
times. And so I knew that I had to do more to help people put into words their own story. Their own story is going to help then somebody else as well. It's creating a life raft of helpers who can help keep people afloat when they feel like they're drowning in grief. And so I developed a creative writing workshop, and it had many iterations, but essentially is the writing exercises that I did myself as I was creating this collection and what I needed to do for my own catharsis. And so it's looking at other people's poems, but then also having writing prompts to generate one's own work with their own story, what they feel comfortable writing about in a supportive space. And it's what I would say is therapeutic, but not therapy. I'm not a licensed counselor or
Sure.
psychologist or anything. Just me using what helped me to help others as well. And I've facilitated this workshop at writers' conferences, art summits, public libraries, just independently on my own for literary nonprofits, virtually and in person. And when my book came out in 2023, that summer, I went on a book tour all over, mostly in the Pacific Northwest and the Mountain West, but all over. And I facilitated this workshop and did readings from my book. And it was such a powerful experience seeing others who aren't writers participating. And one particular memory that stands out was I was at a public library. There was a number of people there, all women, and then one older man. And he didn't share any of his work. He just seemed kind of quiet. I saw him writing. He was doing the exercises. But he came up to me after, and he just said, my wife died of lung cancer. And I said, I'm so sorry to hear that. And just opened it up for him to tell me more. And he's like, it's going to be 10 years this year, and I haven't moved on, and I need to do something different. And he said, my kids told me to come to this workshop, and I'm glad that I did.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Oh my
Yeah.
goodness. It's super interesting because grief is such a uniting thing, and that everybody, I think everybody experiences it in some way, shape, or form, or at some point. And on one hand, it's one of the most researched and taught forms of help and self-help. Like there's books and podcasts and all of these things, and helpers and religious tools and or faith-based tools and communities and all kind of things like that. And on the other hand, it is also something that I don't know anybody who goes into it who feels like they have any idea how to handle it when it comes. And that happens over and over again. And so there's almost no limit to the amount of support that we can offer each other. And the second part about that that I hope comes through in our discussion is that there are people all around us that have gone through this who will stand by you and help support you as you go through it, because that's what you learn when you go through it, is how to just be next to somebody while they're in pain, right? And
Even
so
5 years later, even
oh
10 years later, even 20 years later, it doesn't completely go away.
No, it's very interesting. And so I'm really help happy that you're doing this and that it has done that. How do people find you online? Tell people how they find your workshops and the work.
Yeah, so I put all of my events up on my website, annemariewellswriter.com, and that's WRITER, not RIDER. Not a motorcyclist or a horseback rider. And it's Anne with an E, so Anne, annemariewellswriter.com.
And we'll put
I'm
the
on
link to
all
that
the
in the
social
show
media.
notes. Yeah.
Yeah,
We'll put
I'm
that in the
on
show notes
every
and everything.
social media thing you can think of under Anne Marie Wells Writer as well, the Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Blue Sky. I'm everywhere with Anne Marie Wells Writer.
Very cool. So that will be in the show notes, that link, so people don't have to remember the right way to spell and writer. And it's also, if you're
Yeah.
subscribed to the Imperfect Adulting email community, I put that link in the newsletter that goes out, so you can just click on it and find all the cool things. All right. We're going to close up. I'm going to ask you these three unrelated questions just for fun. This is an especially funny segue in the interview when there's emotional topics that we talk about, because I jump from talking about something deeply personal to things that are sometimes kind of ridiculous. And so I just put that little chatter in there to break the rhythm there a little bit. All right. What's a movie or a show, like it could be a TV show or a movie, that no matter how many times you see it, you will always like stop and watch it? Something that you can watch over and over and over again.
Yeah, the movie Amelie, the French film Amelie. I've seen it probably over 100 times in my life. It came out in 2001. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it. And that's the only one. I'm not really a repeater.
Oh, fantastic. All right. That's really good. Okay. So, thinking back to when you were a teenager, did you have a favorite music group or band? And are you willing to share with us who it was?
Yeah, definitely. Queen. Yeah, I was totally obsessed with Queen. And I wouldn't say that I'm not anymore. I love the music of Queen. I love like glamorous people and wild people. Right now I'm really into Chappell Roan, and I feel like, she's, right in line with Freddie Mercury, with just being different and being willing to be different and not caring what anybody thinks about it.
It would have been interesting if they had been alive at the same time with the
Absolutely.
theatrics now to see what Freddie Mercury would have. As you were describing it, I was trying to imagine Freddie Mercury with the enormous eyelashes that Chappell Roan puts on her, right? That would have been, I mean, because I think there's a chance. I think there's a chance he would have given it a shot. So,
Absolutely.
all right, third and final. Do you consider yourself a morning person or a night owl? I wrote this question before I knew you had a sub 1 year old child, but how do you consider yourself?
I am neither one of those. I am an afternoon angel. I don't know. But even
Fair.
before I had a baby, I don't like waking up early. I don't like staying up late. hit me up at 11. Hit me up at 3 in the afternoon. At that midday to afternoon span is where I peak. Yeah.
Fantastic. I love that answer. I love that it was A or B, and you were like E. I pick none of the above, writing my own answer. I totally love it. That's it. Anne Marie Wells, thank you for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.